With people in New Hampshire going to the polls today,
we'll take a look at how the economy there is just a little bit different from the rest of the country.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Tuesday, the 10th of January.
Some questions we're posing today as we kick off corporate earnings. How are companies doing these days?
Just how much is the euro crisis hurting American companies?
And later, why are some hotels saving used bars of soap?
Those stories coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Well, it is primary day in New Hampshire, and the Republican presidential candidates are anxiously awaiting the returns, which could have an effect on the rest of the primary election season.
And New Hampshire, of course, is a mostly rural state, mostly white and mostly well-educated. And with an economy that's doing a bit better than most of the rest of the country, we can surmise that things are a little different in New Hampshire, and of course, so are the issues. Marketplace's John Dimsdale is with us now to talk about it from Washington. Morning, John.
Good morning, Steve.
So New Hampshire isn't really representative of the rest of the country, perhaps, when it comes to the economy, eh?
Well, like we saw in Iowa, which had its presidential caucuses last week, New Hampshire is growing faster than the national average. Its unemployment is 5.2%, one of the lowest in the nation. Mm-hmm. Poverty is low. It has no income tax, no sales tax. So in that context, you'd think the candidates going after votes in New Hampshire wouldn't need to play up any financial solutions for the economy. But Steve Dupree, who's the Republican National Committee man from New Hampshire, says that there's no way candidates can ignore the economic issues.
They always talk about jobs because they realize they're not only speaking to New Hampshire voters, but nationally, but they focus more on the debt and deficit because this is such a conservative state fiscally.
A state that has a lot of power, John. New Hampshire, of course, lots of candidates have dropped out if they can't perform well, right?
That's right. History, geography, and population give New Hampshire a big say in the making of a president. It's famous for one-on-one relationships with politicians. The primary voters there have an opportunity to look the candidates in the eye, get to know them much better than states that have large media markets, where most of the campaigning is on television. So New Hampshire, well, it may not be representative as far as the economy goes, it does test a candidate's electability and therefore gives them some momentum going into the rest of the campaign.
All right. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reporting from Washington. John, thanks.
You're welcome.
You know, Steve, as I was driving in this morning, I heard on the BBC that they were doing a story about New Hampshire. I always find it interesting to listen to Brits talk about politics.
American
in the
politics.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's sort of interesting. The way that they described it was they said that the way that the nominating contest works in the U.S. is that they wait until one candidate is so far ahead that all the others just drop out,
just
which
drop
is,
out.
Of course, what happens. But you don't think about it that way from our perspective.
No,
but that
and
is
and
from
it's,
the outside.
And it's
that's
usually
the way it
in
looks.
Slow motion for us.
Right. We have to watch every little bit of it. But anyway, Alcoa, the Pittsburgh-based aluminum maker, kicked off corporate earnings season yesterday by announcing its first quarterly loss since 2009.
It blamed that loss on the European debt crisis, but says it's expecting some better results this year, perhaps.
And corporate earnings is where we're going to start now with Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith, Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis, as she is every Tuesday. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So are you expecting global factors like the European debt crisis to weigh on other American companies this earnings season?
Well, there's a lot of yes, but here. The European recession, which clearly they're in right now, is going to have some impact on us. The United States exports about 17% to Europe. So that means basically that we're not sliding because of what's happening in Europe. We're just kind of stagnant. The other thing is Latin America and China are slow growth rate here. So we do see green shoots of growth showing, but there's a lot of weed killer out there. So this is a yes, but it could help us.
And what about the U.S.? Can U.S. consumers sort of come to the rescue if global factors, as you say, are going to weigh companies down?
Well, here's the good news on the jobs data. Very good increase in jobs last month, 200,000 jobs.
Right.
But there are 10 million that have to be recovered here. So that's about 8 short years. Not only that, but the hiring was in low-wage areas, messengers, couriers, restaurants, retail. That's about half. So the need to find a job is being made, but the decent job isn't there, which means that you're going to have very slow consumer spending. Yes, but we are recovering, but it's not a quality recovery.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore and Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Now to Washington, where the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, is holding a hearing today. Officials asking about the safety of daredevil events, events such as the air show in Reno, Nevada last September, where a World War II era plane crashed into a crowd of spectators, killing the pilot and 10 other people and injuring 70 people there. Marketplace's Bob Moon reports.
Planes are supposed to fly mostly parallel to the grandstands at air shows and not point directly at the crowd. But aviation attorney Mike Danko says it isn't the first time that rule has failed to keep spectators safe.
The problem with that, which we should have known previously, is that it doesn't work when an aircraft goes out of control. But that has happened in the past, so the FAA wasn't paying attention.
Danko says the Federal Aviation Administration has created a false impression that it carefully regulates the industry. Mostly, he says, the agency takes the word of airshow organizers.
It would almost be better if the FAA backed out entirely, and then people would know that they're taking their chances.
Michael Barr is an aviation safety expert at the University of Southern California. He agrees regulators need to take a more active role, but points out there's no way to guarantee safety.
Try to look at every single risk that can happen, you will end up closing the air show. You'll just stop all air shows.
More than 10 million people attend air shows in the U.S. every year, and until last year, there hadn't been any spectator fatalities since 1951. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. China today said the gap between what it exports and imports shrank last year. The country reported its lowest trade surplus in 3 years, and China's exports took a big hit in Europe because, of course, the sour economy that's going on there, the European debt crisis. And its import growth took an even bigger hit as Chinese consumers bought fewer things last year. So what does that mean for the rest of us, the rest of the global economy? The BBC's Michael Bristow is with us now from Beijing with the latest on that story. Hey, Michael.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. What's going on here?
So there's two things at play here. Essentially, with exports have slowed because external demand in Europe and in America has slowed slightly. The demand for imports has slowed because demand in China is slowing down. The economy is slowing down here because for the last year or so, the government has been trying to slow the economy down because it fears inflation. It doesn't want to go too fast. So both those things are happening because of different reasons.
What does that mean, Michael, for the global economy?
It means that China was once seen as a big engine of growth, that it would carry on demanding imports of commodities from places like Australia and Brazil, churning out exports around the world. But if the Chinese economy slows a little bit, and figures over the last few months about growth suggest that it is, then that will have a kind of a drag on the world economy as well. And as everybody knows, this is a particular time when the world economy doesn't need another drag.
How does this news, Michael, affect the pressure the U.S. is putting on China to allow its currency, the yuan, to appreciate?
Well, there is still a trade surplus China has with the United States. And whilst ever that is the case, I think there's going to be pressure from the United States to allow the yuan to appreciate. Essentially, the argument is that the lower yuan gives Chinese exporters an advantage over American firms. And so wherever there's a trade surplus, that argument will continue.
The BBC's Michael Bristow in Beijing. Michael, thanks.
Thank you very much.
In the next few weeks, a Spanish company will begin exploring for oil in the deep waters off the coast of Cuba. U.S. personnel checked the oil rig out to make sure it complies with American standards. It does. But that's not stopping some people from worrying about a worst-case scenario in Cuba from looking at big dividends. Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
The oil wells will be drilled thousands of feet beneath the sea. And even though they are about 70 miles from Florida, the oil wells will be in Cuban waters. That presents a challenge in case of an emergency.
The fact that we do not have good relations with Cuba makes any coordination during an oil spill more difficult.
Michael Lynch is president of the consultancy Strategic Energy and Economic Research. He says the Spanish oil company Repsol has a good reputation for safety.
I don't think that we would be under any special threat, especially given the fact that this is a world-class company doing the drilling.
How much oil are we talking about? Paul Weimer is a geology professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder.
It ranges in the several billion barrel range.
At today's prices, 1 billion barrels of oil is worth more than $100 billion. But Weimer says that fortune won't materialize overnight. It typically takes 6 to 10 years to get newly discovered oil to market. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Well, we're thick into the 2012 Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Big news, right, Jeremy? I mean, a lot of folks over there in Vegas right now talking about all the gadgetry and geekdom that's over there.
We've got quite a number of people there from Marketplace
this year.
Yeah, many people there doing blogging and video blogs and audio blogs.
And on-air blogs, all kinds of blogs.
Crazy blogging.
And Boss Hogs and everything else going on over there. Well, you know, the CES, as it's known, I mean, to we're pretty insider here at Marketplace. We call it the CES, right? It's a show that prides itself on all the cutting-edge gadgets on display. But the CES is also about advertising, and one of the major venues for advertisers is smartphone apps, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins explains.
So you're playing Angry Birds, and an ad for ringtones pops up. Rovio, the company that makes Angry Birds, says its games deliver 10 billion ad views a month. Apple says the average iPhone user spends more than an hour a day using apps. That could be one reason why advertising on mobile devices, like smartphones, is expected to surpass $2 billion this year.
The app landscape is becoming more and more attractive to advertisers.
Chad Stoller is a managing partner with IPG Media Lab.
Now, the challenge with that is finding the right apps.
That's not as easy as it sounds. Apps have broad ranges of users, and advertisers are still figuring out who's downloading what. At CES this year, thousands of advertisers and marketers are swarming the floor. Kurt Hecht leads digital innovation and tech for advertising group VivaKey.
I saw, you know, tons of agency people boarding the planes to come here like they would to Cannes or Adweek. That's what this event has become.
So VivaKey and other agencies are trying to bring advertisers and tech companies together, even though they don't always speak the same language. VivaKey is organizing
something called speed dating,
where big advertisers like Procter & Gamble, Nestle, and Citibank sit down with lots of startups who just have a few minutes to make their pitches before everyone heads back to the floor to see the next in a long line of game-changing doodads. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Now, Steve, when you think of recycling,
you
think of boxes and paper and cans,
some of those gadgets that Jennifer was talking about at the CES,
all those things. You can recycle those. But what about soap? That doesn't really spring to mind when you think of recycling. A bar of soap, like those little ones you get at hotels that that they only use a little bit of, but you're not going to go give that to somebody else. You've already used
it. You're not going to take it home.
Well,
that would
as
be messy.
It turns out, recycled hotel soap is the latest frontier in corporate efforts to go green.
Wow.
From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, here's Eve Troe.
When Derek Kayongo came to the U.S. as a refugee from Uganda, a lot of American practices struck him as odd. His first time staying at a hotel, he wondered why the housekeeper replaced his bar of soap every day with a new one. So he asked the front desk,
"What do you do with a partially used bar?" He said, "We throw those out." I went back to my room and I lost it. I understood what it means not to have amenities like soap. Soap is the first line of defense against germs and diseases.
Diseases that kill millions of poor people around the world and could be easily prevented. Years later, Derek Kiongo's rented a warehouse in Atlanta. It's full of huge bins holding thousands of tiny soaps.
So each of these bins has half a ton.
His global soap project collects them from hotels around the country. Volunteers scrape off the outer layer, grind up the soap underneath, and make new bars.
This is what we give to a family of four, and it lasts them about a month, because they take showers not as often as we do because of access of water and all those things.
The project's been limited by shipping costs. For one, soap is heavy, and Kiongo's got just one grinder.
If I had five of these machines, I would make 1 million bars
A new partnership with Hilton Hotels might let him. The company's offered not just soap, but expertise in global supply chains and funding for equipment and transport. Hilton's vice president of sustainability, Christopher Corpule, says it's not meant to sway individual customers to stay at his hotels. Environmental and social efforts give Hilton an edge for big corporate contracts.
Whether it's meetings, events, large customers who do multiple rooms with us, those customers are wanting to know what we do as a company as it relates to sustainability.
Because it helps those clients meet their goals and tell a good story, too. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Alabama, as you know, I'm sure you watched the game.
No, I don't, but I know you do.
I did. I watched that game last night. Alabama won the national championship. And may I say, Roll Tide. So, of course, a big tradition for any team that wins, whatever sport it may be, is the whole dumping the cooler full of Gatorade on the coach thing.
Right.
And that, of course, got some play last night. Nick Saban, the coach for Alabama, got dumped on.
Well, in today's Midday Extra, we will explore the culture and economics of the Gatorade dump.
What? Economics of the Gatorade dump?
There's economics behind everything, Steve. And Monica Hesse, she's a style reporter for The Washington Post. She joins us now to talk about this. Good morning.
Hey, Monica.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, let me ask you first, when was the first original Gatorade shower?
So this is more complicated than you would think it would be.
Of course it is.
So the first one that goes on the record, the one that is usually credited with spawning this tradition, happened in 1985 at a Giants game.
Yeah.
And Jim Burns dunked Coach Parcells. The coach had been riding him pretty tough all week at practice, and this was sort of his retaliation celebration. And that's the one that has caught on, although as the years have passed, there have been rumors that actually the Vikings started it earlier, that maybe there were a few earlier traditions of this. But the one that really caught fire was the Giants in 85.
And is it pretty much every game now, or what?
You know, now it's pretty much reserved for championship games, I would say.
Special occasions,
for either, yeah, big-time rivalries or bowl games, just because you can't have your coach in bed with the flu all season long. And, you know, you're not going to risk your place on the team to do this every week. But for a special occasion, the Gatorade dunk, it remains appropriate.
Is it just Gatorade? Or are we talking other drinks as well? Could be like Coca-Cola. I don't think I have Coke on the side of it, but maybe some sort of, you know, some
coconut
other sort of
water.
Yes,
or,
thirst-quenching beverage on the side on the sidelines.
You know, it has been a variety of beverages. Gatorade remains the most popular because it's the most traditional. And when I talked to Gatorade, I found out that teams are allowed to request whatever flavor they like in the cooler, and that orange and yellow are the most popular flavors to request, which Gatorade speculated might be because the red dye would be harder to get off of uniforms. So just for sheer laundry purposes and cleaning costs, teams are going with yellow or orange instead of the red.
Wow.
Although there have been coaches being dunked with ice water. There have been other beverages, but the Gatorade is the traditional.
Does Gatorade get an economic boost out of this?
You know, it started actually as a spontaneous movement, and Gatorade wasn't aware that it was going to happen, wasn't even aware that it had happened. And so a Gatorade rep was watching footage of a game. He had heard of it, but he hadn't seen it in action. This was back in the 80s. And when he saw it, his team immediately thought, well, how can we monetize this? What should we do? And he quite astutely said, you know, we should do nothing, because it was that kind of viral publicity that you really can't pay for because it's organic.
It's spontaneous and organic,
right.
Yeah.
Right. What Gatorade did do was send a $1,000 clothing gift certificate to Bill Parcells.
I'm sure he appreciated that.
Yes, to say, you know, we might have played a small part in your clothing cleaning bills recently, so we'd like to make up for that. Of course, as the years have passed, the relationship has become more codified. Sports drinks and other beverages will sponsor games, so it's a bit of a different relationship now. But in the beginning, it was organic free publicity.
Monica Hesse, style reporter for The Washington Post, thanks so much for talking with
us. Thanks, Monica.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, a lot of folks embark on some sort of weight loss plan this time of year. You know, watching that Alabama game last night, I don't think the diet was anywhere to
Cheetos,
nowhere
and
to be found.
Pizza,
absolutely,
and,
just
yeah,
all. Actually, wings. I actually got the carton of ice cream out, which was just silly. Just absolutely silly. It was low fat, but what does that mean?
It
really,
does
you know?
Nothing.
One company wants to get involved with the weight loss plan and get your dog, Fido, perhaps involved yeah. too, Jeremy. Nestle, the Swiss company that owns Jenny Craig and Purina, has started an online program to help people and their pets shed pounds. On their website, users can follow overweight cats and dogs on their fitness journeys through movies and before and after pictures, too. But you know what? It got me thinking because I thought, well, if Rover or Spot or Mittens is going Chi-Chi is going to go on a diet with you, well, number one, you're going to be forcing the animal to go on a – they have no choice but to go on a diet.
Right.
That's no fair. I mean, maybe they want to – of course dogs want to eat as much as they want, you know, or eat the table scraps and all that. But if you fall off the wagon with that, I don't know, a big bucket of chicken or apple pie, will you be taking Fido or Mittens with you? Are they going to fall off the wagon too?
I guess we'll have to find out.
It's just not fair. It's just not fair. The animals.
Life's
you got to
fair.
Think of the animals, Jeremy.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiatakis. Enjoy your Tuesday, by the way, and thanks for joining us. Check us out online anytime, marketplace.org. And as we mentioned earlier, all kinds of conversations from the Consumer Electronics Show
CES.
Going on. The CES, as we call it here, the insider phrase over in Las Vegas, marketplace.org. Enjoy your day. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.